You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. Your weekly anarchist radio show here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We also podcast, not quite weekly, on all of your favorite podcatching apps. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of checking out the Toronto Anarchist Book Fair. It was great. Definitely my favorite Toronto Book Fair in a number of years. Good venue, good people, lots of interesting local content that I hadn't seen before, and people who I maybe had seen but not in a long while. It was a really good time. When I go to events like this, I always get super caught up tabling my own zine distro, sometimes trying to find content for From Embers, and also socializing with people who I don't get to see all that often. But I do try my best to also check out some of the content, especially the workshops. Sometimes I do better than others. Sometimes I end up missing the workshops altogether, but I do try to go to one per day. I'm really, really glad I did it this time because I ended up in this really well put together workshop by Toronto's Mining Injustice Solidarity Network about humor and activism. The topic is interesting, and you'll hear more about it in tonight's show, but also they were just really great facilitators and really got the crowd talking and gave me a lot to think about in that sense also about how to do a workshop that works in events like that. I've personally changed my mind a lot over the years about what I think of humorous or theatrical activist interventions. When I was younger and newer to things, it was like totally my jam. I was all about the street theater, the clowning, the dramatic flair. I literally remember going to a protest with a bandana in one coat pocket and a little bottle of kids' bubbles in the other. I think my first ever protest, actually, was when I was 15. We did this staged action where I got to play a blind consumer wearing a blindfold while another activist led me around a grocery store and pretended to explain the products I could choose to buy and how they had been genetically modified or sprayed with pesticides or were otherwise unethical in some way, but all under the guise of they were a salesperson trying to sell me these foods. So they'd be like, oh, but it's so cheap and tasty, don't you want some? And I'd be like, ew. They'd be like, it has fish DNA. And I'd be like, ew. So I was into it. At some point, though, I guess I decided that it was somehow, like, I don't know, not serious enough for me. I remember this little listserv back and forth, email listserv back and forth, where someone posted a critique of our carnivalesque vision of revolution after a demonstration where we had staged like a mask-making table for attendees to make like masks that would cover their faces but were also like funny, so you could be like a lion or a clown or like a corporate clown for this demonstration against free trade agreements. Someone else on that listserv responded with that Crime Think article from, I think, like 2006 called, ooh, I can't say that on the radio, Your Politics Are Boring as F. Even though I would always have said that we should have fun with our actions, I think at some point public displays of irony or of joking started to feel like maybe a little bit hokey. I felt self-conscious. I didn't want to do it anymore. Like, I felt like stage fright about it. Like, people were kind of looking at me. And I let myself pretend, I guess, that my actions were somehow like more serious. And that's why I didn't want to participate in those kinds of things anymore. But actually, I think a lot of what we do and a lot of the things that I've done are just as much about making a point as that anti-Monsanto grocery store walk when I was 15. Just sometimes we like to make those points in more combative ways, but also sometimes we like to make those points in, I think, more ritualized ways. We like to do the same things kind of over and over and over again. And when it starts to feel like we've been to the same protest 10 times this year already, theatrics can be a great way to bring some much-needed fun and creativity back into the mix. So I kind of miss those street theater actions, those funny interventions, the costumes, the drama, and I don't think it really does anything to undermine the seriousness of what we have to say. The Mining and Justice Solidarity Network is really, really great at using humor and drama to make some really serious points about Canadian mining companies and the horrible things they do around the world. I really get the sense that they spend very little of their time in the streets standing around with signs like chanting and yelling, but prefer to get much more creative with their public actions. Their workshop about humor and activism really, really got the crowd talking about the ways that they can and or do employ jokes in their various struggles and campaigns. So while this interview is mostly about opposing Canadian mining, I think there are take-home points for all of us in all of the various struggles we're engaged in, whether that's anti-fascism, climate justice, anti-police organizing, prisoner support, whatever it is we do day to day. In mostly unrelated but kind of related news, the Canadian election is coming up next week, and I've been feeling somewhat at a loss as to how to engage with that circus. If anyone out there has done something creative to oppose the electoral crap show and would be willing to chat with me about it, I would really love to rep that on the show here. I feel kind of like this every time those lawn signs start to go up, and I would love to feature anarchists who have come up with a creative or interesting way to deal with it. That would really help me feel like maybe there's things we could do when this time inevitably comes around again. If nobody is doing anything, and you're all kind of like me, just wishing you had some better ideas, maybe this week's episode will help us get our general creative juices flowing, and maybe we'll do something more fun next time around. Here's my interview with Kate of the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network.
My name is Kate Klein. I am a member of the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network based here in Toronto.
And what is the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network?
The Mining and Justice Solidarity Network, or MISN for short, we call it MISN, is a grassroots group based in Toronto. Our mandate is to resist the harmful impacts of the Canadian mining industry from our position as a group of people based in Toronto. The Canadian mining industry is, you know, has reaches around the world and projects around the world, but a significant amount, I would say the majority of the kind of capital and the benefits from all of the wealth that's extracted from communities around the world all kind of flows back here, and a significant chunk of mining corporations are headquartered in Toronto. So we are a group that tries to take advantage of that positionality in direct support and solidarity with people who are living in mining impacted communities, who are doing like frontline direct struggle to protect their communities, and doing what we can here in what we call the belly of the beast to try to hold these companies accountable, put pressure on them, try to make it hard for them to do business as usual in spaces that they're pretty used to being pretty used to having be like echo chambers where there's very little resistance.
And what made you want to get involved with that organization?
I didn't know a ton about mining, to be honest, when I joined MISN. I had moved to Toronto and was interested in getting involved in grassroots organizing. And I knew I wanted to do something that was kind of like anti-capitalist in nature, anti-colonial in nature. And there was a couple of different options in front of me. But I knew a little bit about MISN because a dear friend of mine was involved with them then, us now. And I had just heard really amazing things about the actual experience of being in the group. It's a group that is really, really kind of forefronts like care and community and access and its kind of mode of organizing. So I was like, great. And then my experience of this kind of stuff is that once you start learning about it, you can kind of never go back. And it's been 5 or 6 years now, I think, that I've been involved with MISN.
And what would you say are the politics of the group, if you had to describe them?
We're a very explicitly, like I was saying before, like an anti-capitalist, anti-colonial group. It's very important to us. We have a lot of allies that are nonprofits, and they do really important work at the kind of, you know, advocacy policy level. But it's very important to us that we're a grassroots group. It means we have a certain kind of autonomy that means we can be a lot more flexible and have a lot more agency in how we choose to kind of approach the issues that we're engaging with. And we use, you know, different kinds of tactics, ranging from kind of like public education to more disruptive things in mining industry spaces. Very much from we think of ourselves as a feminist group as well, thinking really about the intersections of, you know, how these issues impact people differently. Both thinking about the gendered impacts of mining, you know, women tend to be the first to be harmed in mining impacted communities and also benefit the least from the so-called benefits of mining projects, and are also most often on the front lines of struggle in land defense and water defense struggles. But to us, a feminist ethic also applies to the way that we do our organizing, really thinking about relationships as being at the heart of everything that we do, both relationships with impacted communities, but also relationships with each other and with others in the Toronto community, the Toronto activist community.
Hmm. So like, why mining? What's wrong with mining?
Good question. Well, I mean, we could talk for hours about whether there is such a thing as ethical large-scale mining. I'm not particularly convinced of that, but I think it's definitely it's difficult to argue with the fact that mining as it exists right now, as supported by the Canadian state, is deeply harmful to communities that are kind of facing the brunt of the projects. So the Canadian mining industry in particular has a worldwide reputation for being one of the worst violators of human rights, of environmental safety, and of labor rights in its practices. And what that looks like really depends on the context, so where the mine itself is operating. So for example, Canadian mining companies will operate here in Canada, largely near Indigenous communities, and have to follow certain kinds of laws and regulations, and still do get away with a lot of pretty terrible things. But the laws are such where there's certain kind of processes that they have to follow. But in other communities and other places around the world, in many ways, because of many, many, many years of Canadian intervention in the mining codes, for example, of different countries, Canadian mining companies are able to get away with a lot. I guess, a lot more flagrant violations of communities' rights, predominantly Indigenous and kind of rural communities. And so, again, I can spend a long time kind of enumerating all of these different violations, but, you know, people are getting shot, assassinated, communities are being militarized in service of these extractive projects. There's a couple of cases in Canadian courts right now where Canadian mine securities have been accused of gang rape of people who are being in the process of being evicted from their communities. It's really, really horrible stuff as you start to explore it. And those are just kind of like the explicit violations, not to speak of the deep and devastating environmental harms that are caused by large-scale industrial mining projects, especially open pit mining, which are having often irrevocable damage on communities. So there's a lot that's wrong with Canadian mining, with mining in general, but the Canadian mining industry is a particularly egregious perpetrator of a lot of these kinds of violences.
And what are some of the campaigns or projects that MISN has done since you've been involved?
I mean, we're always working on something. and the way that we've approached our work has really changed, even just in the time that I've been involved with MISN. And so we historically, springtime has been is our most active time of year when we hold something called Spring into Action, which is like this massive explosion of protests and demonstrations, which isn't just by accidentally in spring. It's because that's when most of the annual general meetings of the mining companies that are headquartered here in Toronto are held in kind of late spring, early summer. So it's really important to us that these events, these kinds of like legally required convenings of stakeholders don't happen in a vacuum, right? That companies that are causing extreme harms around the world cannot get together and brag about their victories without somebody being there telling the truth about what they're doing. And so, you know, sometimes we show up in really small ways at those annual general meetings, but have really worked hard to try to work to make sure that people from impacted communities as much as possible can actually just speak directly on behalf of their own experiences in these spaces, which is often not met with much excitement on behalf of the companies. So that is something that we are always kind of working at and is growing and changing every year. We also are a pretty constant presence at something called the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada Convention, or PDAC, which is the world's largest mining convention that gathers in Toronto every year. Which again is just, it's PDAC, we think of it as kind of like the propaganda arm of the Canadian mining industry. It's where, you know, people gather, it's important to show up and show your face and be seen as a important member of this kind of thriving economic community. And it's also where a lot of the kind of ideas and stories that the mining industry tells itself are recycled and pushed forward. So just like with the annual general meetings, it's always really important to us to be there and to try to bring people inside and actually see what the inside of spaces like that can be like and feel like. So we're already starting to think towards PDAC 2020, which will be in the end of February. There's a lot of behind the scenes work that that is done when you're a kind of solidarity based organization. So we spend a lot of our time behind the scenes doing different kinds of actions and tasks in support of mining impacted communities. So we're spending a lot of our time right now working on kind of building and strengthening some new relationships with impacted communities that we don't have a strong, long history of working in support of. We're also making an app, which is definitely not our, you know, our strength, something that we're used to doing. But we have this walking tour of the financial district that we've been doing kind of in person for a couple of years now that we're turning into a self-guided app. So lots happening behind the scenes.
Cool. Yeah. I was going to ask you next about whether and how you have direct relationships with people in mining affected communities outside of Canada. like how you meet those people, how you connect with them, what those relationships are like.
It's totally different. It's really case by case. So some communities that we have relationships with, that relationship is formed because a member of our group, sometimes even before they were members of our group, spent time in that community. You know, we have some relationships with people in Guatemala that were really formed and strengthened because we have members in our group who lived there, who were doing human rights accompaniment work, or, and then that relationship just strengthens when you move back to Toronto and, you know, a community reaches out to you saying, hey, this thing is happening. What can you do to help us? And we do what we can to kind of maintain that kind of trusting bond. Other times we just get emails from somebody in a community very far away saying that something's going on, and they were just looking on the internet for people based in Canada who could help. And so we do what we can based on kind of our assessment of like how much we know already about the situation and how much we can figure out about who this person is and the perspective that they're coming from. And other times our relationships with communities come from our coalition work. So right now we're working on kind of beginning to do some work around the Ring of Fire, which I don't think we would have been able to do before unless we'd been a part of kind of networks of people doing work here in Toronto, who were kind of connected to some people who were interested in building their kind of spreading their message and creating a bit of an Ontario wide network. So it looks different each time, and it's very complicated work, but super important that our work isn't happening in the absence of relationships with people who are being directly impacted by what for us can feel theoretical if we weren't, you know, engaged in these relationships.
So obviously the group is specifically about mining. Do you have links with like other organizations or groups in Toronto or elsewhere that work on maybe different issues that you see as connected? Like, do you think of yourself as part of like any sort of broader movement or struggle that goes beyond mining?
Yeah, totally. I mean, mining is super connected to a bunch of other things. So we've been working really hard in the last few years to draw connections between mining or kind of extractive industries in general and like migrant rights organizing, because so many people who are, you know, fleeing countries to Canada are actually being displaced by Canadian companies in their home communities. Obviously other kind of environmental justice groups, Indigenous rights organizations. Mining is a contemporary manifestation of colonization, so it's really important to us to make sure that we're really foregrounding the Indigenous sovereignty pieces of the work that we do. And just in general, it's important to us to kind of keep this Toronto piece at the forefront. So even working with groups like who are doing like anti-poverty organizing in the city, helping to draw the connections between the ways in which like wealth, the wealth gap, and the disparities, and who gets to even access the kinds of resources that come from these corporations' profits are so stark in a city like Toronto, where, you know, the homelessness crisis is, you know, rapidly expanding, and especially during times like PDAC, where you see people from all over the world kind of flooding the city and staying in downtown Toronto and getting drunk after the convention is over, kind of at the expense of people who actually live here, who are trying to live life in an ethical way. That disparity is really important for us to highlight. So yeah, there's a lot of really important connections, and we definitely do see ourselves as part of a broader, broader movement here in the city.
Can you tell a story of like one of the most memorable or favorite actions that you have been a part of with the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network?
I think that one of my favorite actions to be a part of was a couple of years ago for PDAC, so the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada mega convention. We organized a bus tour that we were calling the Toxic Toronto bus tour. Some of your listeners might know about the Toxic Tour that happens often, taking people from Toronto and surrounding areas to Omgenong First Nation to see kind of firsthand some of the devastating effects of environmental pollutants in that community. So we were kind of imagining that this would be a bit of a kind of inverse to bring people to the source of the toxicity in the financial district. And we organized it as a bit of a kind of street theater or like bus theater intervention where we packed like 100 people onto two big yellow school buses. And we drove around the city, well, around the financial district, kind of pretending to be a representative of the Toronto mining industry, kind of using satire, using humor as a way of helping people understand the connections, not just between mining corporations, but also like the connections between mining corporations and the academy and the media and the financial services industry and all these other things that are kind of coexisting in downtown Toronto up along Bay Street. And so, one person would pretend to be a mining industry representative talking about all these exciting things that are worth bragging about. And then we had a plant on the bus who would kind of call them out and interrupt them and correct their facts. And I think a lot of people who decided to participate in the bus tour kind of walked onto that bus not knowing a lot about the Canadian mining industry and why it was important to resist, and got off the bus like pissed, which was good because we stopped the bus at the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada convention and welcomed people to go in and express themselves however they wanted to. So that was a really fun project. And I feel like it was one of my favorites because I feel like it was very kind of complex and we were pulling off a lot of moving pieces all at once. And it felt like a nice blending of, you know, using humor, using kind of theatrical tactics, but also like really trying to help people build analysis and build understandings of what these connections look like. And also just literally bring people and like plunk them in front of the Metro Toronto Convention Center and support them and kind of engaging with that space in a way that reflected how they how they were thinking and feeling at the time. Still feel very proud of that action.
That's awesome. Yeah. Your group has seen some amount of repression over the years. I believe people have been sued. Is that correct? And definitely, I know that you believe that you were infiltrated in advance of the Pan Am Games. Do you want to talk a bit about that and also about how your group has held it together and like stuck it out for years despite that kind of stuff?
I don't have any knowledge of people being sued. Okay. It's possible that happened before my time in Missin. It's definitely always a concern because mining companies are very lawsuit happy when it comes to allegations of, what is it, libel? slander? Anyway, they're very lawsuit happy when it comes to people accusing them of things that are true, but that they don't want people to think are true. I mean, we did have an experience a couple of years ago of having some people in our group who, I mean, to this day, we still don't know who they were. I'm waiting for the day when I have just like cold, hard evidence. But we definitely went through a whole process of kind of investigating and kind of looking into and trying to get a little bit of certainty around, you know, feeling certain that they were not who they were saying that they were, that they were kind of misrepresenting themselves, and went through a whole process of then like kicking them out of our group. And we released a zine recently called Damage Control, kind of telling that story and some of the lessons that we learned from that whole process, which you can find at www.infiltration.fail. and I would say, I think this is where this piece around relationships being so important comes into play. and why it's so important to the work that we do and the activism that we do. Because I mean, I was one of the people that was like really deep in this whole infiltration thing and trying to figure out who these people were and figuring out how to kick them out in a way that would keep us safe. And it can obviously make you really paranoid and feel very suspicious of people who are working alongside of you. And we have always prided ourselves on being a group that's very open. That can be like a kind of first entry point for a lot of people in getting started in grassroots radical activism. And that's been so important to us for so long. And that particular period of time, I feel like I can only speak for myself, but that kind of impulse to just be open and welcoming definitely felt very challenged in that time, because it felt like we were being taken advantage of for being so open and for being so kind of focused on bringing people in, even if they were still really early in their process of learning, like what activism can look like. So I think what felt really important to us at that time, and definitely still very holds very strong after the fact, was just really focusing on taking care of each other and making sure that our relationships stayed strong amidst all of that, which meant, you know, as we were like, oh my God, are we going to get arrested? Like what's going to happen here? Like what information is being shared with whom, who are these people? Trying to be like really strategic and like really tactical around that, but understanding the maintenance of our relationships as being central to those tactics. Because the whole idea behind infiltration is that it's about kind of disrupting relationships, right? You know, pitting people against each other and making you feel paranoid and making you feel suspicious and making you not feel like you can trust each other, so that you'll then rely on this person who is not who they say they are. So yeah, I mean, just really prioritizing that, really always putting that at the forefront of everything that we do, making sure that we can be whole, complex human beings, and also trying to laugh a lot amidst the sometimes quite depressing work that is combating the Canadian mining industry. I think that there's you know, a strong legacy of patriarchy that tells us that relationships and emotions and the kind of heart work of activism isn't valid or isn't worth anything or isn't, it's kind of like a side important thing. And it's not the center of the work that we do. And when we say that we're a feminist organization, that's a big part of what we mean when we say that, is kind of doing away with that notion and remembering that relationships are actually at the center of everything.
You are listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, or podcasting in various corners of the internet. This week, we are featuring the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network, and particularly a workshop that a couple of members of that group did a few weeks ago at the Toronto Anarchist Book Fair about humor and activism. So we're talking about theatrical interventions, humorous takes, staged protests of various sorts that these folks are using to oppose the Canadian mining industry in their home in Toronto. If you are more interested in the mining side of things and the group itself, I'm going to post their website in the show notes. So if you are in Toronto and you're like, hey, I also hate Canadian mining companies, I would like to get involved in this specific campaign, you can check out their website and contact the group and hopefully get involved. They do a lot of really great work, and mining is a super, super important issue here. Canada is like a big player on the world stage when it comes to extraction, especially in the global south. And there are lots of folks in Toronto and elsewhere opposing that machine. But now we're going to go back to that interview and hear more about humor and drama and theatrics in the activist work that these folks do. That's a great answer. And it's a good segue, too. I was going to ask you about a workshop that you did a while ago at the Toronto Anarchist Book Fair on humor and activism. I think that's what you named it.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about the premise of that and why you decided to do that workshop in particular this year?
Totally. I mean, we're used to doing our kind of like mining justice 101 workshops. But it just felt like a good moment in time to be talking about what it means to laugh in our movements. Like the work that we do, I don't know, maybe especially right now in this moment in time, maybe not, feels so dire and sad and, you know, enraging. And it is, it should be. We should be mad, we should be sad. But it can be really easy to immobilize in those feelings and to feel trapped and isolated and a little bit hopeless about the possibility of change. And so we decided to offer this workshop at the 2019 Anarchist Book Fair because it felt like an offering that we could make as a group that has always really valued kind of humor and play and satire and a kind of like theatrical way of showing up in the streets and showing up in corporate spaces. And just to kind of remind ourselves that humor is not only the thing that keeps us okay and alive in the midst of such constant devastation, but is also strategic, right? Is also a tactic that we can use quite thoughtfully to help us build the world that we want to live in.
What are some examples of like the kind of humorous stunts or actions that we're talking about here?
I mean, so there's different kinds of humor, and that was one thing that we spent some time in the workshop exploring, was different ways that humor can show up. And the different kinds of risks and benefits that each one can come with. There's like naive humor, which is all about kind of pretending not to understand that the actions being taken could be interpreted as protest, kind of showing up and pretending to not know what's going on or pretending to kind of just be a casual bystander. A really good example of that was an action that took place in Toronto in 2012. A bunch of folks from Grassy Narrows, as well as kind of solidarity activists here in Toronto, organized like a fish fry that they invited a bunch of politicians to. And the fish fry, so for those of you who don't know, Grassy Narrows is an Indigenous community in Ontario that has been impacted for many, many, many years by mercury poisoning as a result of industry and like blatant neglect from the government in terms of any sort of accountability or like the reversal of the health impacts. And so there's been really amazing, like very inspiring activism happening around that for many, many years. So this is just one example. So a bunch of politicians were invited to this fish fry, like a traditional fish fry, where the local fish from Grassy were being cooked in an open wood fire. But anybody who's been following what's happening would know that the rivers are poisoned with mercury, and so the fish probably would not be very good to eat. And so this is a good example of naive humor, because the fish was just presented to these politicians with the kind of the vibe of like, well, why won't you eat this? what's going on? What would make you not want to eat the fish that comes from the water in this community? Which really put the politicians on the spot in either denying that they knew what was going on and having to put themselves at risk, or choosing not to eat the fish and thus kind of showing that they knew that there was something dangerous happening here and that they were just choosing not to act. So that's one example of a very kind of strategic, humorous intervention. Another example that I think a lot of people probably have encountered at some point, is an example of what we might call absurd humor, which is just about like general raucousness, silliness, slapstick kind of humor, which often is manifested by like clown interventions. I think many of us have probably seen different examples of people using clowning, even in like extremely tense situations, where like police are intervening on protesters in violent ways. Sometimes having clowns there can make even the most like cop supporting people question the use of force that's being used against protesters.
Why do you think those kinds of humorous or dramatic interventions are effective?
I mean, there's different reasons. What I was saying before, like funny things just help us be okay. And that matters so much in kind of maintaining our momentum and maintaining our spirits, even when it feels like, you know, what we're up against feels overwhelming and sometimes impossible to defeat. There's, I think, important things to think about around thinking about the strategy of humor. I know that Misson has kind of encountered this over and over, and I know that we're not alone in this, that sometimes we can get in a bit of a rut, planning the same kinds of actions over and over and over again, which is like not the most strategic thing to do. So there's something about planning humorous actions that can just insert some pause in what we're doing and create opportunities to be thoughtful about strategy, not just doing the same thing over and over again, but thinking like, oh, how do we want to approach this, and what could be different, and what are we actually trying to achieve, and is there a way that we can kind of tackle this or kind of present our message that nobody has ever done before? So there's a kind of creativity that it can generate. It's definitely been our experience that in thinking about engaging with whatever audience it is that we're trying to engage, especially on the street, is that humor can prompt people to approach instead of turn away. So when you're being playful, when you're being, funny, or you're using, kind of big kind of theatrical actions, people that, might otherwise just walk right by you, because you're like just another protester, stop and look and want to see what's going on. Which can provoke a certain kind of engagement that might not happen with a more traditional protest.
What are some of the like dangers or pitfalls associated with using humor in our activism?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the biggest risks is when humor just doesn't go over well, right? When your audience isn't connecting to the point of the joke. When humor goes over people's head, or when it relies on a certain kind of shared understanding of the world, or just like cultural reference points in order to be understood, the risk is that people won't even know that you're joking, which is really risky when you're using satire that is about kind of replicating and exaggerating status quo ways of thinking and talking about the world. Mm-hmm. And then obviously humor can be kind of tricky to wield because, it can offend, right? If it's not wielded appropriately. So when somebody is joking about something that isn't their life experience, or, you know, they're trying to be edgy and it just kind of doesn't catch people right, or when the target of the joke is like marginalized people instead of people in power, jokes can fall flat or even actually cause more harm than good, even when it's coming from a good place of trying to actually do something about a terrible situation. So it does have to be wielded thoughtfully, I think.
How do you know? Like, how do we know when is a good time to make a joke and when is not a good time to joke? Do you have like an internal guidebook to like ethical and effective theatrics?
That's a really good question. Sometimes I think it is just about trying it and being open to people responding and telling you that it wasn't a good time. I think that especially with, I think it's especially tricky with solidarity activism, right? When you're doing activism that is about issues where you are not the person being oppressed, like a lot is the case for a lot of the work that we do in MISN, being in dialogue and being in relationship with people who are being directly impacted by the issue is important, right? So you're not just making a decision, in bad taste, but you're checking in, you're making sure that, you know, it's in line with what people are, kind of how people are hoping to frame what's going on. I don't know if we have like a kind of set of rules or principles. Mm-hmm. I think what is most important is just that it's thoughtful and that it's strategic. Like definitely, I think especially because the work that we do can be so overwhelming and heavy sometimes. Sometimes I've definitely had many experiences in MISN meetings where we're planning for an action and then somebody thinks of just this like really funny idea and it's so exciting because it's funny and it's making you laugh and you can just kind of, you know, get caught up in the joyousness of the moment, that you lose touch with the thoughtfulness or with the strategy of it all. So I think something is important to get swept up in that joyousness, but then to come back to earth a little bit and think, all right, what is it that we're trying to do here? Is this, you know, punching up instead of punching down? Are we the people to make this joke? Is it going to be understood correctly by the right people? And yeah, that can be a useful way of kind of thinking it through.
Do you ever worry that making a joke or staging a theatrical piece or something kind of makes light of situations that are actually extremely heavy, like makes things seem less serious when actually the battles that we're fighting are not light at all? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think that is, we should be worried about that. And that is always the question. The way that we kind of talk about our humorous interventions is that we take the struggles of mining impacted communities very seriously, and the bullshit spun by mining companies much less so. And I do really think that sometimes if you don't laugh, you'll cry because things are so horrible. But it's super important that the joke is never about the suffering, and it's just about, it's being used tactically and strategically to help highlight inconsistencies and hypocrisies and like the terrifying implications of the kind of status quo thinking. So yeah, it's like, what am I making light of here? And what is this humor doing instead of just doing it because it feels good? Feeling good matters, but I think that it can't be the whole picture.
Do you count like all theatrical presentations of ideas as humor? Like, for example, recently Extinction Rebellion in my town has been doing like die-ins. That's a theater piece. It's certainly about suffering, but I would think of it as like not a joke, but rather like a piece of serious drama that's meant to provoke thought. Does that count as humor?
I don't think so. Not necessarily. Like we did an intervention. I can't remember what year it was, but the Pan American Games were happening in Toronto, which is like this huge international sporting event, which was kind of terrible for many different reasons. But we particularly were organizing around it because the medals being used and the medals were being donated by a like terrible mining company that was headquartered in Toronto. And so we did this long series of theatrical interventions in the parking lots, like in the places where people were lining up outside of sporting events, where we would show up with milk crates and wearing like pennies that said spoil sports and smear leaders printed on the pennies. And we had these medals, like these like cardboard medals around our neck that said like Barrick Gold Kills and things like that. And we set the milk crates up so that it was kind of structured like you know, like the first place, second place, third place platform that people stand on when they win in a sports game. And we wore the pinnies and we stood on the crates wearing the medals and we just sobbed outside the sporting games in this really kind of like exaggerated theatrical way, just to create like a feeling of dissonance around the feeling of the thing. Because all these people standing in the parking lots being like, woohoo, like curling, or like that's curling isn't a summer sport. It's probably some other summer sport, tennis. And then these people over here who were just like very intensely weeping and like, what's going on and why are they crying? And we passed around like water bottles that were just like tinted green with food coloring that were like, oh, the water from the mine. And things like that. So that was an example of like a theatrical intervention that, I mean, I think it's funny. Like, I think it's funny because I have a broad understanding of the kind of big picture, but the feeling that we were trying to evoke was not humor. It was like discomfort and like some sort of misalignment between what's happening and what's happening in the crowd versus what's happening with these people. But the boundary between these things, I think, is quite fuzzy.
Mm-hmm. What were you hoping people would take from your workshop? Like, what is the problem that you were hoping to speak to, or the kinds of like thoughts that you hoped people would have coming away from it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, us anarchists can take ourselves quite seriously. So there's a little bit of a desire to always remind ourselves to have a little bit of levity in the way that we think about things. And to think about that as like both something that will help us feel good, but also something that is strategic. And to think about humor as a tactic that is in our toolkit, that is just one of many tactics, but that is a valid one, that has like a history, long, long history of actually effectively making change. But then also not to kind of romanticize humor. So it was really important to us that like a huge part of the workshop was just kind of unpacking different examples of humorous interventions to think about. Was it ethical and was it effective? And to kind of practice some of that thinking through that is so needed in order to produce an effective and ethical humorous intervention. So I hope that we did that right.
And how do you think it went? How did people receive it?
Good. I feel good about how it went. It was like a morning workshop, so people were a little bit sleepy, but I feel like the conversations that we had of kind of unpacking the examples were really rich. I feel like people did a really good job of really kind of thinking it through, right? It can be really easy to react to something as just like, whoa, that's offensive. But like, why is it offensive? And what makes it so? And what makes it dangerous? And what do you think that they were trying to do? So that I feel like we really kind of got into the nitty gritty of that. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
What are some campaigns or struggles that your group has going on right now that you want people to know about, or maybe actions coming up?
Mm-hmm. I think I touched on most of them before. If you're based in Toronto or near Toronto somewhere, keep an eye out for PDAC 2020. Mm-hmm. I hope that we are going to have something pretty exciting coming down the pipes for that. Pretty soon we'll be done the kind of first phase of this walking tour, this financial district walking tour app, and we'll be looking for help with like beta testing it, which I think will be really fun.
Fun.
Walking around in the financial district with this little baby app and telling us about all the things that are wrong with it so we can make it better. I think those are the two major things that I can think of that people can keep an eye out for.
Yeah. And if people want to find out more about you, or maybe even like get involved in the stuff that you do, how can they find you?
Yeah, so our website is www.mininginjustice.org. Or you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/miningInjustice. And if you're interested in getting involved, we usually try to have some kind of like orientation sessions a couple times a year. So you can just email us at info@mininginjustice.org, and we'll get back to you about when the next time that that will happen will be.
That's all I've got for you tonight on From Embers. I hope that folks have heard Kate's words and are feeling inspired to get out there and do something new, something funny, something dramatic, something a little different from what we've been doing. And again, if you would like to know more about the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network, about Canadian mining companies, about how to get involved in the struggle for people's land and freedom and control over their own lives, you can check out their website, which I will post in the show notes right here. Thanks for listening.
Slaves looking for relief from the steaming hot plate of bullshit served up on the daily by the mainstream media? Are you thirsting for solid and reliable information to escape the mind-numbing vortex of corporate news and Trump tweets? Are you ready to check out every time you hear Despacito on the radio one more fucking time? Then tune your dial to Sub.Media, a mouth-watering hub of infotainment and subversion that'll make you want to quit your job and join the motherfucking resistance. Dive into our newly designed website and gorge yourself on one of the 500-plus videos and audio tracks from our vast library of anarchist films, hip-hop, and riot porn, or choose from one of our original shows, like Trouble, Burning Cop Car, A is for Anarchy, Video Ninja Reports, and The Stimulator. F*** Netflix. Watch Sub.Media.